Well, could you first tell me, Mr. Jenkins, where and when you were born?
I was born in the borough of Lambeth on the 20th of October, 1930. Yes.
And who were your parents?
My father, Mr. Obviously a Mr. Sidney Jenkins, yes. And my mother, Mrs. Ellen Jenkins. Father came from a background of nine brothers and one sister, very large firm. My mother's background was just her brother. No introductions if we're talking about coming back into city connections. And one of my father's elder brothers worked on the Stock Exchange in a clerical capacity. And introduced my father to the Stock Exchange to do mathematical work, as in those days everything was done manually, and this was his introduction into the Stock Exchange, and he progressed from the office eventually into the, that was probably in the 1920s, then he moved into the Stock Exchange 38, 39. And then progressed from there.
Did he start doing clerical work with a jobbing firm?
Yes, in the rubber market, because in those days, markets were often you get the rubber boom or the mining boom, and firms in those days were generally very tiny. They would probably have two partners, or even one partner and one on the staff, and suddenly to do 50 or 100 bargains a day would put a tremendous strain on the system. So they would get in temporary staff to do the clerical work. Bearing in mind that the bargains would have to be worked out manually, posted in the jobber's ledgers, that you would then work out the journal separately, they would then cross-tick them. So there was, it was a lot of actual office work compared with modern times.
Can you remember the names of the firms that he was with?
He was originally with, no, I can't go back to the early ones, but the one he started with that I remember most is a firm called Ormiston Wilkes, which were a very small jobbers, had a small rubber book and a small industrial book. That was actually when he went into the market. And that was sort of his initiation onto the trading floor. The beauty about the early days was that there was three sort of stations as regards clerks. Once you came onto the chain of going into the Stock Exchange, there was an account day clerk who wore a BAS badge, which was a triangle with a yellow outside and a green centre to it. And then you moved on to a red button, which had a red centre round with a white circle. And this, in fact, is a blue button, which was the most treasured badge to get, which meant that you got your first rung on the ladder.
Yes.
And that, in the early days, that was the only badge worn. No members, authorised clerks, would not wear any badges at all. So you had to have a very good memory on who, what people were with, what firms. Because having traded with a broker as a jobber, and you didn't know who he was, you wouldn't ask him, "Excuse me, sir, who do I bought that bargain to?" You would have to send a blue button and follow him around the market until you found somebody at a distance who recognised him. So that was the early days on badges.
It's the bell.
Then we introduced the, that's the blue button's yes. Badge, the equivalent with the firm's name on it.
Yes.
And that was white or silver badge, which was the member's badge.
I see. So this, the original blue button.
That was an original.
It's about the size of a very large cufflink.
Cufflink, yes. Worn in the lapel at all times. Yes. There was a very strict discipline in the early days. I mean, I went onto the floor in 1946, and I think people were disciplined in those days in any case. To go on the floor without your badge on was absolutely not thought of. It just didn't happen. And you kept out of everybody's way as a blue button. There's always stories about Percy Duke, who was had a habit of stepping back on blue button's feet and then accusing them of bumping into him, and he had a bit of a reputation in that field.
Mm. Do you have any particular memories of your father and his work from when you were a boy?
Well, not in my childhood, no. We didn't actually, in my early days, we didn't talk a lot about the actual business. When I was about 12 or 13, he used to bring home some of the books because he'd made up his mind that I was going to work on the stock exchange, and there wasn't any deviation from that in his mind. That was the only world he thought I ought to be brought up in. Mm-hmm. And looking back, some regrets, but not many. The business was very kind to us in the early days. Very interesting business. An opportunity to meet lots of people. Mm. 2,000 or 3,000 people on the floor of the exchange at any one time. Mm. So it was quite an exciting time, really.
Mm. Your father was quite determined to keep the firm going and to keep it a family firm.
Well, when we go back to my history, I actually started with a little firm of brokers called James Watson. They were in Copthall House in Copthall Avenue, which is now the Accountants Hall. There was a little tiny building there, and I started there at the age of 14 as a stock runner, where most people started at that sort of area. And that way you learnt the firms, their addresses, and you became familiar in that area. And also you would have to take stock to company offices for certification and registration. That way you learnt the different companies, the different names. You learnt about preferences, ordinary, debenture. You didn't realise it, but it was a very slow or quick learning process, which was there all the time, but you didn't know it was happening. And then you would... Then from James Watson, I went to another little tiny firm called H.W. Burks, and I wasn't with them too long.
Was that a jobbing or a
No, they were brokers. Firm? The two first firms I was with were brokers. Mm-hmm. And then I joined my father in a firm called John Owen, which was an old established firm. And there were two partners with the firm. And my father actually at the time was what they call a half bookman. The firm did all his settlements, and he took half the profits, and he had a very successful business. Then he was invited into the partnership, which meant that the profits were split three ways. And then the old senior partner died, and that left two partners. And they eventually fell out in 1955, and the firm shut down. And I went back for a short time stockbroking with firm called Williams de Bray, which is Hill Chaplin Williams de Bray now. They still exist in another form. And then in 1960, I went back to father in 1956 when he became established with a firm called E.S. Godden. And they more or less financed my father's book. And it was really trading in the same leisure company. We've always specialised in leisure shares. And father started the business back with E.S. Godden, starting the book again, and I joined father about a year later. Mm. And as a result of that, in 1960, father took the business over. I became a member in 1960, and the firm became S. Jenkins & Son. Mm. And that was the partnership. And I think we took the firm, the staff over from the old firm. And I think we had three on the staff. Mm-hmm. And eventually we grew as the years went on. My brother was introduced into the business and two other partners. There were five partners, and we actually had five on the staff. So there was, we were 10 overall. Mm-hmm. I remember meeting the senior partner with James Capel one Christmas when they used to have their soirees, and I was saying, I don't think I could manage a firm of this size. And he said, well, how many have you got on your staff? I said, well, there's five of us. He said, oh, 500. I said, no, just five people. And I think he had about 600 at the time. He wasn't, I don't think he was too amused. But it was a family firm, and everybody knew one another. You know, we knew when people had families and passed their driving tests, and they were good days, good days.
Can we just go back a little bit? Where did he send you to school before you started working as a stockman?
I just went to the ordinary elementary schools. Mm. I didn't have any special education. Mm. Funny thing, Father had a thing about that. He said, give me a good barra boy any day to run a book. Mm. In the early days, university and higher education, if you like, didn't really make very good jobbers, market people. Mm. There obviously were going to be a few exceptions, but most of the early traders, probably even going back to the 30s, were elementary school boys who'd got this art of trading. Mm. And I think this seemed to be... When I think the markets became more international, I think it was more important to have a much deeper education, because the whole thing changed completely. I mean, in the early days, an announcement made in Manchester about court orders was probably the most important thing of the day, and nobody really cared whether Wall Street was up, down or sideways, because they'd probably never even heard of it. So in the early days, it was really just local trading, local knowledge, your contacts, general contacts. And you must bear in mind that, as I said, you grew up, you became a red button, a blue button, and by the time you've come through the chain, a lot of your friends that you've grown up with, you would meet them again on the trading floor. So your contacts were building up the whole time. So it was a different... It didn't really matter what school you went to, because the old boys' network didn't really work too well.
You said that your father was a half-bookman.
Yes.
Was that with John Owen?
John Owen, yes.
Were there many half-bookmen?
Oh, yes, quite a lot, yes. Mm. In fact, Terence O'Hearn will tell you, I think he said there was something like, well, maybe getting my figures wrong now, 300 jobbers in the mining market. Now, he will probably verify those figures. Now, we're going back to what I said before. A firm could consist of one partner and his office manager, and that could be a firm. And often this type of firm would not run a position overnight. They would undo their book on another jobbing firm, which was, which happened quite frequently. You'll probably find that there was only 20 or 30 main trading firms, and there was a lot of smaller people on the outside getting a living out of it, really. I think a lot of that happened, what we used to call spoon-fed jobbers, that the small broker with the one partner, one clerk, and the clerk would not necessarily be a house clerk, he would be just an office bound, as it were. If the partner suddenly got 30 or 40 orders, there's no way he'd be able to cope with those. So in the case of which market they were in, he would go to his favourite jobber and say, put some prices on that for me. And never would a jobber take advantage of the broker that is what we call opened. He would give him his list and he would run down, put the prices on it. He'd call back 10 minutes later and his business is done at the correct price. And that was the... That was one way that trading was done. I suppose it disappeared in the 50s, really, that type of trading. But the client, in some ways, I think he did benefit from it.
How did these half-bookmen actually fit into the firms? They weren't partners.
No, they weren't partners. They literally took half the profit on the book.
Yes.
And the firm... it also worked in the broking side. The dealer, whether it be a member dealer, an authorised clerk, he would be registered as an agent, and it was a question of what you negotiated with the firm. I mean, in latter years, with the expenses being so high, these percentages came right down, but half bought was normally 50-50, and the firm played the expenses. Bearing in mind, expenses weren't very expensive. You know, they were quite low in the old days.
Did they decide off their own bet that they wanted to start running a book?
Yes, that's a good question. I think if you were entrepreneurial in those days, and you would normally have a little bit of a sponsor. Father's early days was a chap called Stanley Pryor of AJ Pryor. They were brokers, and he was the broker to Margate Estates, Ramsgate Olympia, and Dumpton Thanet Greyhounds, and Bellevue Manchester. And father literally started the leisure book just by trading in four of these stocks. Stanley used to find him a bit of business now and again, and he added GRA to it. And in the finish, in the height of the boom in greyhounds, there were probably 30 greyhound companies, Albion greyhounds right the way down to Wimbledon Stadium. And then there was the rationalisation, tote tax, and all sorts of nasties. The list condensed right down. And in fact, I think it's just Wembley Stadium now owns most of the greyhound tracks now. There are a few private ones. But the other thing in those days was that the prices of shares weren't terribly expensive. You know, the dearest one on the book might only be 3 shillings. So, in fact, S. Jenkins and Son started with a capital of £20,000. That's all that was necessary in 1960. Rent was only £1.50 a square foot. We had one telephone. We had one exchange telegraph phone, which is the equivalent to the STX line now, which was a manual exchange in Bartholomew Lane. And this is what I was coming back about, the communications. If you actually wanted to speak to a person on the floor of the house, you either had to go to the door, which was allocated to that person. We'll put it another way. A firm was allocated a stand in the stock exchange, and the numbers went from 1 to 15, although one or two of them were eliminated. And that stand had a door allocated to it. So if I wanted to speak to Walker Cripps on stand 11, I would have to go to the main door, and I would walk up the steps, which had a little tiny... they had a rail up, so you didn't get in the way of the members going in and out of the building. And you had to ask the waiter, can I speak to Mr. Byford of Walker Cripps? And he used to get his speaking tube out and blow down it. And that used to sound a whistle the other end, like you would get on a bridge of the old ships. And hello, and he'd put the thing to his ear, and he'd get the message. And then the waiter would call out three times, Byford, Walker Cripps. And if he didn't answer, he would then put the light up, which was a light number, three-digit number, allocated to that firm. And it was up to that individual to wander around, when he's wandering around the market, to keep an eye on his light to see if he was wanted. And then he would put his hand up, the waiter would see that he spotted the light, and he would point to the door, or if he was wanted on the telephone, because the telephone rooms were located around the edge of the market, and he would just tap his ear and point that he was wanted in M room or whatever it was. And that was, there was no direct lines from the offices onto the floor of the house to the firms. If you wanted to speak to your firm, you would have to leave your pitch, go to the edge of the market, go into the Bartholomew House Exchange private rooms and say, I want 825. And he'd say 825 on 6, and you've got to find box 6, and you went in it and you stood up in the box. And I always remember it, they had a false floor on it, and as you stood in it, the floor went down and it knocked out the ticket on his by the operator, and he would know that box was occupied. And it was the phone was fixed to the wall, and you just took the earpiece off, a bit like a Western style. So communications were very, very primitive in the old days.
This was the setup when... around 1960?
This was in the 40s.
Right. When did that start to change?
It started to change probably in the 60s. We were allowed one telephone, I think, per firm on the pitch. Mm-hmm. And it was not allowed to have a bell on it. It was a big red light on it which flashed. No bells were allowed to ring on the floor of the market. But there was a lot of resistance to this by the brokers. They thought that jobbers would get a lot of privileged information. The company announcements were, that was a very poor system in the early days, because the a bell would ring and the company announcement would say ICI on board. Well, ICI is a very large company issuing quite a lengthy statement. And this thing would just be pinned up on the board, and there's 40 people want to read it, and that is the only copy. And this got changed in later years through sensible discussions. Market makers were issued with a copy of this. As it came out, they got a copy straight away. And a lot of the big firms, realising that this difficulty, made available company announcements and reports to their brokers that were held until the time of release, and then they were released generally in the market, which was much more satisfactory. But you were liable to get picked up, as we used to say in the trade, by somebody having the information before you. Before we had insider trading and things like that, which must have been rife in the old days, I should think. And because jobbers and brokers, very few jobbers actually spoke to one another. There was not a very friendly atmosphere in the original markets whatsoever.
Again, are you talking about when you started about the
40s? In the 40s, more yes. So in the 40s.
Yes.
There was a strict procedure if you knew that your opposition were bidding for a stock that you were quite keen to sell at that price, it become a choice price, as we term it, and you think, well, I've got business on and I need to take this price out of the market, and you would go over there and you would say, I want a deal in London General Crab at 3 6 months in 25,000 shares. And the jobber might just shake his head. If he said yes, it was up to me to open, not the person you've challenged, although very, very often people were around the other way. But that would probably be the only conversation you would have with what one termed in those days with your opposition. Mm. It was a very closed society, it seemed. And then as the years went on, one or two of us used to have sort of coffee together, and one of them would say, oh, I had that dreadful fella on last night. And then you'd suddenly realise that you had the same villains, the same problems as every other jobber. People that were opportunists, shall we say, and they used to try and bully you, and you realise after a while that he would say, oh, but these are offered away in any case, and you say, all right, well, I'll put the bargain down, and they were never offered, and you found out that they were not always telling the truth, these people. So
these are the brokers you're
These are the brokers, yes.
Well, you've referred to your relations with other jobbers. What were the relations with the brokers like? Were they just as...
Very good, actually. Mm. Yeah. There was always an odd few brokers, and I suspect that we all experienced the same, that you wouldn't trade with. But you could get over that by making a very wide price, because there were no rules on how wide the price was, whether they were buyers or sellers, or even the size. So if there's a chap there you didn't like, and there was a market in 50,000 shares, and there was a tuppenny price, then you would make him a sixpenny price and 1,000 shares, and he would gradually get the message that he was not welcome, and that was it. So in a way, we controlled what firms we wanted to trade with. Because the other little small part about this, if you felt a firm was a little bit unsound financially, you could put your own safeguards in and not trade with that man. In theory today, you can't do that. You can't govern who you trade with. As a market maker with a price on the screen, a mandatory price on the screen, then it doesn't matter who the person is, he can come on and trade with you in the amount you're showing on there. You can't say, no, I'm sorry, I don't like your account. It's not possible. So there was a little bit of security in a way, really, if you didn't like a way a firm conducted its business, etc.
Did you mix socially with jobbers and brokers outside of the house?
Not jobbers,
no.
Although Colin Nock, I've known Colin for 50 years, and we both finished up with the same firm, but we've always stood within 20 feet of one another, all through the original market, temporary market, and then the rebuilt situation. So, but I would say my broking friends socially were probably only about 10. Whether that was the time I was, struggling, bringing up a family and all these things, and perhaps I didn't have too much cash to go out and socialise, I don't know. I suspect that was probably the problem.
Where had you been living before you became a member and before?
I lived at Ilford with my parents. Mm. I then got married and moved to Chapel Heath. And then we moved from there to Woodford Green, I think the normal progression, as the finances improve, you tend to move to slightly different areas. Mm. And then finally I moved out to the country, out to Bishop Stortford. Mm. It's a funny pattern that actually, if you a lot of stock exchange people you'll see, I mean I actually lived at Dagenham for I think either 1 year or 2 years when I was about four. And there's a lot of stock exchange boys come from Dagenham or Dagenham. Some of them don't like to be reminded of it, but there is a steady progression out and out and up, I suppose. Really.
And about when was it that you became a blue button and you first went onto the floor of the house?
It's very approximately the 22nd of October 1946.
What were you?
That was 2 days after my 16th birthday, because you weren't allowed. That was the earliest you could become a blue button. Mm. And in those days, the earliest you become authorised was 21, because that was the law of the land. Mm. And it was a Friday, I remember it well. And I had the audacity to wear a brown suit, which was something totally, totally forbidden in there. It was the only one I had, and Father was taking the day off or something and insisted I went in. But it was a bit frightening, actually. Mm. Although people were kind, looking back at it, they could have been a lot worse than they were.
And what did you start off doing as a blue button?
Just running messages to get yourself familiar with, you know, with the work, which in those days, if you wanted to locate a firm, you had to know which stand it was on. That was the important thing. And some of the larger firms, of course, had two stands. So Fenn and Crosthwaite were on stand five and on stand two, and so you really had to get to know. Because the theory was that if a broker had left you a limit, then and you wanted to bid for this stock or offer in the stock, then you'd got to get to that stand, you know, pretty quickly. But I must confess, though, that if you got on well with the waiter, they used to bring in timing of slips after a while, and you'd write on the outside Fenn and Crosthwaite, Coddington, and then you'd put the time on the slip, and the waiter was supposed to keep these all in line. But if the waiter knew you and you didn't put the time on it, the chances are yours might be at the top. So that was a little bit of a... They were characters in themselves, the waiters.
Do you have any general impressions of what the stock exchange was like at that time?
Frightening, absolutely frightening. Mm-hmm. Because there was a tremendous discipline in those days. I mean, you weren't allowed to run in the market. Speed was essential. I mean, this was, you had to have a sense of urgency, as I say, without running. The other thing you had to get was the marks, which if the market was fairly quiet, you'd be more than sensible to keep looking at the marks, to keep off the pitch, because there's nothing worse than three people hanging around on a pitch and apparently not too busy. I can remember my early days as in the checking room. And I wasn't the only one guilty of it, that if during some of the bad times you'd only got two bargains to check, I mean, you customarily went down to check at 10 to 10, and you shouldn't leave your seat until, say, 10:45. If you did, then, I mean, if you went down and just checked your two bargains and left, I don't say it'd be all around the market, but they say, oh, they're not having a good time at the moment. So you put this big bluff up of sitting on your seat and calling out for people who you knew couldn't hear you, because you could see them right down the other end of the checking room. The checking room was the same size as the dealing floor, basically. And the ironical thing, well, it's not ironical, you didn't actually sit on the seats, you sat on the tables, and you put your feet on the seats, and you had your jobbing book on your lap, because the brokers were walking round confirming all the business that their dealers had done the day before. And so you would make a bit of noise and make it look as though your firm's had a busy day. Mm. And you'd never let anybody look at your book, you know, your people would sort of have a look over. So, yeah, that's a vivid memory of my early days. But I think this was a lot of, in the early days, I think the Stock Exchange did have a sort of secrecy about it. I think this is probably what's missing today. When people do large bargains, it's immediately revealed. Mm. In the old days, business was done. You didn't even know what the size was, what the volumes were. And it certainly did have advantages. If a job is taken on a chap in 500,000 shares, and he doesn't really want to tell the world about it. Mm. because if you've got enemies in the market, then they'll ruin your book. You know, that wasn't unusual in the early days. You know, it can be quite dramatic.
Do you have any impressions of the actual floor of the house also?
It was enormous, really, yes. Well, I suppose a lot of people don't realise outside the Stock Exchange, the floor, the original floor, as I term it, had a dome, the third largest in the world. The first one was St Peter's of Rome, then St Paul's, and then the Stock Exchange. But of course, this wasn't something you could see from the outside, unless you were in perhaps one of the adjacent buildings. It wasn't particularly decorative, but often there would be sing-songs in there. There were different characters in the market, and as I say, there could be 2,000 or 3,000 people in there. And if there was a lull and nothing much going on, perhaps on a Friday or something like that, somebody would start a bit of a sing-song going. And one I always remember talking about the dome was a chap called Latouche, who was with a firm called Hirsch, Stokes and Wilson, firm of brokers, and they mainly specialise in the mining market. And they would sing the Marseillaise to him, because he was supposedly a Frenchman, and he actually looked like a Frenchman. There wasn't any doubt about that. And in the